Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. I am your host, Anna Fishson, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Bruce Fink about Volume 2 of his latest book, Against Understanding, Cases and Commentary in a Lacanian Key, published by Routledge in 2014. So about a month and a half ago, we had Bruce on to discuss Volume 1 of Against Understanding, and it's great to have him back on the show. Bruce, welcome back.
Thank you, Anna. It's great to be back.
Thanks. So, for those who have not listened to the first interview, I'll introduce him again. Bruce Fink is a practicing Lacanian psychoanalyst and analytic supervisor. He trained in France for 7 years and is now a member of the École de la Cause Freudienne in Paris. Bruce obtained his PhD from the Department of Psychoanalysis at the University of Paris 8, Saint-Denis, and served as professor of psychology from 1993 to 2013 at Duquesne University in Pittsburgh. He is currently an affiliated member of the Pittsburgh Psychoanalytic Center. Bruce is the author of six other books on Lacan, translated into many different languages, The Lacanian Subject, Between Language and Jouissance, from Princeton in 1995, A Clinical Introduction to Lacanian Psychoanalysis Theory and Technique, from Harvard, 1997, Lacan to the Letter, Reading a Cree Closely, from Minnesota, 2004, and Fundamentals of Psychoanalytic Technique, A Lacanian Approach for Practitioners, by Norton, 2007. He's also translated several works by Lacan, including A Cree, the First Complete Edition in English, published by Norton in 2006, for which he received the 2007 Nonfiction Translation Prize from the French-American Foundation and the Florence Gould Foundation. Okay, so let's dig in. I first would like to ask about your inaugural chapter, actually, which is provocatively titled Analysand and Analyst in the Global Economy, or Why Anyone in Their Right Mind Would Pay for Analysis. I love that title. Mm-hmm. So now I want to ask something very basic, actually,
sure.
Which is, what is the goal of analysis, or in your view, and what role, if any, does money play?
Well, that's a big question.
how about what is the goal? What is the goal? Yeah. I mean, the ultimate goal. Yeah.
The ultimate goal. Well, let me just first say that, I wrote that paper for a specific conference on psychoanalysis and money in London a few years back. And it was a lot of fun to sort of take up the topic and, money was talked about seriously, I guess, back in the early years of analysis, and it was always related to anality and so on. I thought it could be more fun to talk about it in other ways and to relate it in particular to the notion of loss in psychoanalysis, that the money that you spend on an analysis, it may seem at times like, you're just throwing good money after bad, and that, what exactly is it that you're paying for? you know, how different is it from paying, I don't even know if they have 900 numbers anymore, but they used to, where, you know, you would pay to be talked dirty to or to talk dirty to somebody else. What exactly are you paying for? And one way that I tried to formulate it is that you're paying for loss. You're paying actually to lose something. So on the sort of specious analogy with working with a personal trainer with who you pay to lose pounds, you know, in a certain sense, in psychoanalysis, we pay to lose something, something that we are loath to give up, to let go of. It's usually, you know, characterized in Lacanian terms as a certain kind of a jouissance, a certain weird satisfaction, even unpleasant satisfaction that we get from our symptoms, and that we keep holding on to. In a sense, it's the kind of the enjoyment, the paradoxical enjoyment that we're familiar with. We know how to get it's familiar to us, and yet that's often what we complain about when we first go into analysis, that's, you know, it's not the enjoyment that we want. We don't want to be satisfied from self-pity or moping or depression or this or that. I mean, of course, there are lots of ways of characterizing what the goal of psychoanalysis is, but one of them, at least the one that I tried to pick up on in that particular article, is the way in which it is often so hard for us to let go of a certain way of achieving satisfaction to hopefully move on to some other way of achieving satisfaction. Mm-hmm. And so...
Yeah. Yeah, I like the way you explained it. Can you relate it actually to the, this is, I'm kind of skipping ahead or thinking ahead to some other papers, chapters in the book, but perhaps you can link it to the traversal of the fundamental fantasy, what Lacan calls that, you translate it as the traversal, some translate it as passing through the fantasy. Well, maybe you can begin by just explaining quickly to non-Lacanian listeners out there, what is the fundamental fantasy and what does this have to do with the loss, this loss of jouissance that you just talked about?
Right. I mean, I think even a lot of non-Lacanian schools accept the notion that obviously we all have plenty of fantasies and that perhaps there's one or a couple of dominant fantasies that are organizing our psychic life for each of us. And the idea in Lacanian psychoanalysis is that there is one sort of matrix or fundamental fantasy around which perhaps hover a lot of other variations on that fundamental fantasy, and that fundamental fantasy is very much at the crux of how we situate ourselves in life in relation to other people, and where our satisfaction and pain in life come from as we try to situate ourselves in relationship to other people in a certain way, which for many repeatedly doesn't work out very well, works out for a little while and then completely collapses or backfires. So, you know, we can think of, very roughly speaking, of the fundamental fantasy when somebody comes into analysis complaining that, you know, their relationships always keep working out more or less in the same way, that they get very intensely involved with somebody and then that person leaves them. So it seems that in a certain way they're playing out perhaps the same thing over and over again. which maybe, for example, in certain cases, leads to a smothering of one's partner and, you know, an attempt to control that partner such that the partner ultimately leaves. And so the question is, well, you know, what is it that the person is trying to achieve and why doesn't it work out? And how can we uncover what's holding that particular strategy in place such that some other outcome might be possible somewhere down the road? Mm-hmm. So the idea of traversing the fantasy is to figure out what makes it so compelling to the individual to play out a certain kind, to try to position him or herself in relationship to a partner in this very specific way, and hopefully in the process of figuring out what makes it so compelling, it's no longer so compelling. Mm-hmm. And so that some other ways of situating oneself in relationship to a partner become possible.
Mm-hmm. So when one passes through or one traverses the fantasy, if that's one of the goals of analysis or the goal, what happens to one's subjective position when that fantasy is traversed? I'm curious about, does this obsessive ever become a hysteric, for example, when the fantasy changes form, isn't there a danger that there would be new problems? So something else congeals, something else becomes rigid, and something else becomes compelling. And so I'm wondering if we ever really come to the end of analysis, you know, in this way, if this is the ultimate goal. Can you speak to that?
Right. Yeah, I suppose there certainly could be intermediate points along the way, which are not really resolutions of the fundamental fantasy or really a traversing of it, but that are sort of partial moves in that direction. Yes, there's certainly no moment at which somehow all fixation disappears, or in another vocabulary, there is no longer any symptom, right? I think one of the things that Lacanian analysts perhaps emphasize more than a lot of other analysts is that there is always going to be a symptom of some kind. And the question is, how do you make do with your symptom? How do you live with your symptom? Is it something that paralyzes you? And the idea is that the symptom undergoes a transformation, of course, in the course of an analysis. And maybe, but as you indicated, for example, you could be left with a different symptom. But hopefully it's a symptom that you can live with a lot better. We're all aware that certain kinds of symptoms allow one to get by better in the world than others do. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a part of your question that I've forgotten at this point.
Oh, just subjective positions.
Right. So, roughly speaking, regarding subjective position, I think that, for example, where someone comes into analysis fundamentally convinced that he has been a victim of other people his whole life, the hope is that, and he positions himself presumably in relationship to other people in such a way as to continually confirm and reconfirm that he's a victim. And so, entering a certain workplace, perhaps, where there's no victimization of him at the outset, he perhaps somehow orchestrates it or brings it on, or sees it when it isn't there necessarily, but perhaps even drives the people who could victimize him in such a way that they begin to victimize him. And the hope is that at least that sort of thing ceases, that he begins to see his own role in creating the kinds of relationships that that he has in life. And so there could be some sort of weird reversal where then suddenly he begins victimizing everybody else, but hopefully that's only a stopping point, not a stopping point, but rather a sort of, you know, a way station on the way to something else.
You've been saying symptom a lot, and I was thinking, actually, it just occurred to me that you don't seem to, at least overtly, make a lot of use of Lacan's later writings in your, at least in the cases, like the 1970s Lacan, specifically the concept of the symptom. Do you, I mean, yeah, is this something that you do think about? And it just it hasn't, maybe it's not coming through as much in this in these particular volumes?
No, I think that his later work informs my work to some degree, but I would still say that, you know, for myself personally and perhaps for many other people as well, the direct clinical relevance of some of that later work is a bit less clear. And, for example, the notion of the symptome is far more relevant, it seems to me, to psychosis and perhaps, you know, what's come to be known as ordinary psychosis than it is to good old ordinary neurosis. And you know, the what I strive to do in this book in particular is to talk about practice, talk about the theory of practice, and you know, not dwell too much on the really tough later work, which is very theory laden. You know, perhaps that'll be the subject of future writings. But, you know, there are a few people now who are starting to, you know, really try to talk about more systematically Lacan's later work. But it remains extremely opaque. For example, you know, I've sometimes been tempted to try to translate texts like L'Étourdie, right, which came out around the same time as Seminar 20. And, I mean, it's just, you know, untranslatable. So no matter how many years of French I've had, it still remains, you know, the clinic. And so, you know, the theory is already so difficult, and the clinical applications of it are, for me at least, remain to be elucidated.
Okay, well, let's pivot then to something a little bit more down to earth, which is actually in the next chapter offers that opportunity, because it's again, nice title. What's so different about Lacan's approach to psychoanalysis? So one difference that is rather controversial and that most people know about is the of course the variable length session. And I've heard two arguments actually against variable length sessions from the inside, so to speak, I'm sympathetic to, and I've
from the inside of people who have worked with Lacanian analysts,
also like these are points that have occurred to me, and actually I'll just be totally upfront. So Slavoj Žižek, during a Q&A after one of his talks, was asked something about it, about variable length sessions, or he brought them up. I'm not sure anymore. And by the way, this is all on YouTube, so it's not. I'm not giving anything away here.
Right.
Nothing confidential.
Okay. Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
And he said that he's actually skeptical about them for two reasons. And the first basically is that when things are bad for the analysand, like when he or she needs needs the analyst more, when they need consistency. In fact, Žižek, again, was quite candid and talked about when he was in his 20s and in analysis with Jacques-Alain Miller, and he was like sort of suicidal. He would say to himself, I will end it all now. But then he'd think, oh, wait a minute. I have an appointment with Miller tomorrow at 4 o'clock mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. I'll have to see him first. So mm-hmm. point being that sometimes one simply needs that guarantee, that consistent presence, to be sure that the analyst will be there for a set time, especially when reality is disintegrating, when there's in one's personal mm-hmm. life, or there's a revolution sure. even going on, or whatever, when mm-hmm. When the phantasmatic fabric is tearing, one needs to know you'll be there for the full 50 minutes, I guess, or the full 45 minutes, whatever it is. Okay. And the second argument is essentially that...
I'm sorry, I just would point out that, at least based on what you just said, though, the idea that the analyst will be there at 4 o'clock the next day, it doesn't mean, that it... didn't sound like he was referring to how long the analyst would be there for. And of course, I think, most Lacanian analysts have a very regular schedule as well. Whether you see somebody 3 times a week or 5 times a week, it's at regularly scheduled times, more or less. And so you're there. The question is, for how long? But anyway, I'll leave that aside.
Yeah. Okay.
Tell me whether, yeah.
Well, the second point is actually I find more compelling or more. Well, it's there are a few things. So, okay, how do you know that a given association or a slip or whatever is the most important in the session? So, I know very well this phenomenon that you discuss when you. Where you give this example a lot, where you hit on something, in a session surprising and powerful, and then there are like 10 minutes left in the session, right? And then you're exhausted and scared, and you don't spend the time talking about that pivotal, that surprising, powerful insight, or not insight even, but just slip, whatever it was. Instead, you talk about what you did last night, your trouble with colleagues at work, some other banality, okay? But the question is, but isn't this part of free association, and why can't this potentially yield something interesting too? And Zizek pointed out that he needed to BS before he could say anything worthwhile, or worthwhile stuff emerges sometimes from the prosaic. And then this other point related to that is, this is what interests me most. So the point at which the analyst scans the session necessarily becomes the most important point retroactively. So how does one really know it was the right move? In other words, it always becomes a display of mastery. It feels like, yeah. So maybe you can speak to those points as well.
Right. Yeah. In my own experience, the scansion doesn't necessarily become the most important point. And I hear repeatedly from analysts and they say, well, I don't remember where the last session ended. Okay. I figure at that point, that just means I was barking up the wrong tree or maybe it'll yield some fruit later down the road, but, it didn't have much of an effect. Now, maybe, there'll be a dream that will get recounted in the course of the session that turns out that it speaks somehow to where we ended the prior session, but certainly not always. I would say no, there's no sense in which we know that this is the most important point. I would say that it's, at best an educated guess based on everything you've heard from a patient and from, work over the years with patients in general, and that hopefully, a reversal of a point of view, somebody saying the exact opposite of what they meant to say, that will bear fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times it doesn't. But it can, and sometimes it can be a very powerful tool. So,
mm-hmm.
I would eschew the notion that it's a display of mastery in the sense, at least, that certainly, the analyst doesn't know that it's going to have some sort of powerful effect. Oftentimes it just falls flat. And, you know, the patient says to herself, well, I don't know what he was thinking, but, you know, and that's fine. And sometimes, you know, that's just the way it goes, that, you know, what the analyst thinks is very significant is not what the patient finds very compelling. But that happens with interpretation. That happens with every kind of intervention one can make,
right.
not just the scansion of a session. I've talked with lots of analysts who were convinced that they were absolutely right about what was going on, and yet it had no impact on their patient. And so I think then we have to rethink what we think is so right about it. And
so it's just another tool in the toolkit, in other words.
That's the way I see it. Yeah, mm-hmm. That it's certainly not the only toolkit. When people reduce sessions to the point where they last 2 or 3 minutes, as, you know, sometimes has happened in the worst of cases in France, then I think you're right. There's a certain display of mastery. There's obviously very little time, if any time whatsoever, for interpretation, for questions, for interpretation of dreams, fantasies, and so on. And the scansion becomes the only act that the analyst seems to make then. That, you know, that strikes me as absurd, personally. But And so then to your comment about good things can grow out of the prosaic, the question is, I guess, one of timing. You know, what I would prefer is that we not end with something prosaic, because then my sense is, and having been in analysis myself an awful lot, that you go away... You do go away. I mean, at least it seems, you know, psychological studies have shown that, you know, the unfinished task or the perplexing task is what, you know, keeps your mind working the most. And so if you go into prosaic blah, blah, blah about everyday life at the end of the session, that's probably what's going to be on your mind then for the next half hour, or, you know, possibly even the next day or two. Whereas, you know, if something sort of unsettling is where the session ends, that's likely what's on your mind for the next period of time. So the prosaic, you know, I think everybody deals with the prosaic early on in the sessions, and we try, when the patient doesn't have a dream or something really important that they want to talk about, and they start talking about, you know, small conflicts in everyday life, we hope to sort of, you know, dig deeper and, you know, or relate that somehow to something else they've been talking about, so that we leave the surface of things and we move in a direction that might have some more impact. But hopefully we end, at least in my view, hopefully we end with something impactful. And, you know, even if we started with something prosaic, we don't end with something prosaic. But, you know, that's maybe a stylistic.
These are good arguments, I have to say. Also in this chapter, we're going fairly slow through the chapters, but I have to address this. It's so good.
If I could ask you to hold that thought just for one moment, I did want to, address maybe it's a misconception people have sometimes about how Lacanians work, at least in my experience. You know, when Slavoj Zizek was in crisis, it's very likely that his analyst asked him to come back a second time later that day. I happen to know Slavoj, so and I know a bit about his analysis as well. His analyst saw a patient sometimes twice a day, and people who came in from out of town saw him 3 or 4 times a day. When people are in crisis, there are lots of different approaches you can take. Some people, you know, they think that a certain frame whereby the patient comes in twice a week, come hell or high water, has got to be stuck to. you know, I have never known anyone in the Lacanian world who practiced like that, and that when a patient is in crisis, you know, I try to see him as much as seems necessary. And, you know, if it's already, you know, 8 o'clock at night and, you know, it's not clear that the worst is over, you know, I just let them know they can always call me later and we can talk and, you know, I'll see them the following morning or whatever. So there, you don't have to have necessarily a fixed 45 minutes because it isn't necessarily the amount of time that's going to make the anxiety go away or that's going to sort of lead to some sort of talk that will allay certain fears or certain suicidal tendencies, but there's always at least the notion that you're going to be talking again, and you're going to be talking again very soon. That's what I always personally found helpful, and I think that's what a lot of people find helpful.
Mm. And you're unlinking time and money, I guess. You're not saying that this amount of money is worth X amount of minutes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, first of all, that's true in lots of professions where not everybody uses the, you know, the legal the practice among lawyers where, you know, an hour equals $1,000, right, as I hear in New York anyway, you know, and so therefore each minute costs, I don't know. You know, there are lots of professions in which money is not exactly equated with time,
but
you know, for some reason that's happened in psychoanalysis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, okay. So I'm going to ask about jouissance now, since we mentioned money again, and somehow
right,
last time we were talking.
Sure.
Okay. You explain in this chapter why jouissance is more important than affect and feelings and analysis according to Lacan. And I guess, yeah. Do you think that there's an overemphasis on feelings during analytic sessions these days? And what about, I guess, pain and suffering? Does acknowledgement of that or recognition of the analysis and suffering have a therapeutic effect in your view during the session? Because if you... You know, you say, so just talk about this, you know, overemphasis on affect. Do you stick by this today? What does it mean to focus more on jouissance than affect, et cetera?
Well, that's, again, a very big question. I think I mentioned perhaps the last time that I recently translated Colette Soler's book called Lacanian Affects, where she talks about sort of the way Lacan does talk about affects, in particular
right,
anxiety, sadness, and so on, and how he formulates them within his theory. I think that I think that where I would differ from a lot of people is with the notion that it's only when affect appears in the course of a session that somehow you believe you're on the right track.
Mm-hmm,
and that
yeah,
you're talking about the right thing. And if the patient is not showing much affect, isn't angry or happy or crying, that somehow, you know, you don't have real rapport with your analysand, you know, you're not really working somehow. It's all... Again, some of this seems to tie in with the notion of the corrective emotional experience, that the analyst is there to somehow help the analyst and come to feel differently and feel correctly or something in a sort of process of a kind of reparenting.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, Freud... or in his very early work already in The Interpretation of Dreams, talked about how affect can be so misleading that in a dream, for example, often the part of the dream that seems most affect-laden, most intense, is actually when we start associating to it, it's not really the crux of the dream somehow, but another part. So there's been a kind of displacement or a metonymic slippage of the affect, so to speak, from one part of the dream to another as partly a disguise, right? So that, right, the dreamer won't recognize exactly what's going on in the dream, wake up screaming or whatever the case may be. And also, I think Freud already indicated that your analysand may cry or, become very morbid at a certain point. And often it is not necessarily because that's so painful necessarily, but because there's something there that they don't want to talk about. They may be very well aware of that. We haven't hit the real, so to speak. It's not as if every manifestation of affect in an analytic session or in life, in a lover's dispute, for example, we're all aware that when someone, including perhaps ourselves, breaks down and starts crying, that doesn't mean that something, the most painful thing has just been said. Sometimes it's just to get somebody else to stop, right? To stop bothering us, to change the discourse, to try to move on to something else. When you don't know how to handle somebody in a certain situation, if you cry, I'm not saying we all do it in a totally calculated manner, but I think that, first of all, that's a kind of caution to realize that affect can sometimes be misleading, and that if we take it as our guide, we're likely to be misled and to allow ourselves to be misled. And when patients talk about things and they say, oh, that was the most painful experience in my life, it could be a screen memory. It could be that actually another incident related to it is actually the most painful, not that one. And we have to be careful not to do what I think a lot of people do, which is say, oh, yes, that must have been very hard for you. That must have been terrible. Because also at the same time, the things that are presumably, that seem at least on the surface to be the most painful and the most difficult were also the most jouissif, as they say in French, right? The most bizarrely enjoyable or satisfying somehow. And that's why I think if we pay attention to jouissance, I'm talking a mile a minute here, but thinking about the Rat Man case again, because I'm thinking of writing a book sort of going through some of the work I've done teaching Freud for the last 20 years. And in the Rat Man case, Freud notices at this one point where the Rat Man is talking about this horrible torture that he had, a form of torture he'd been told about by a certain captain, this rat torture. I won't go into the details. he said, that he had this curious, the Rat Man had this curious expression on his face, right? And the way Freud described it was of somehow an enjoyment or a satisfaction unbeknown to himself. And so, sort of he was, we can see this sometimes even when people are on the couch, if we crane our necks a little bit, that somebody is talking about something that's presumably horrible and there's a bit of a smile on their face. Or sometimes people, talk about things that seem horrible and they're laughing. And not just to, as a social way of trying to, mitigate to the other person the difficulty of something, but sometimes because there really is a certain enjoyment there for them. So I think that if we adopt the same logic of suspicion, as I call it, that it seems to me we need to use in analysis in general, right? When the patient says, it's Not that I mean to criticize what you've been saying, yeah. But right. Of course,
bad
we
sign.
Right, yeah. Right, we, yeah. And but the same thing, you know, that we take manifestations of affect in the same way. We note them, of course. We don't ignore them, but we need to be suspicious of, you know, what exactly is going on. What exactly does it mean? Maybe it could possibly mean the exact opposite of what it seems to mean.
Right. Well, you mentioned in passing, and I don't know. I'm afraid we're going to go down the rabbit hole with this one, but you mentioned hitting the reel.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you could elaborate, because I think there's some confusion about what that entails, really.
Right.
You know, and
right.
it does seem at moments like I sort of get it, but then what does it really mean in practice? You know, like,
right.
So
sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and when I used it when we were talking earlier, I meant it in a sort of conventional sense of perhaps, you know, like we hit, you know, this thing that is truth of the subject somehow, right? That we really hit the heart of the matter, and that affect somehow is the absolute truth. It's the Holy Grail. It's what we're looking for. So that's just one thing I would caution against, you know, that affect is not necessarily mm-hmm. the Holy Grail. The Holy Grail is when we get to something and something seems to get shaken up or shaken loose, and things are different after that for the patient. Mm-hmm. Even if there was no big show of affect during the session or even immediately thereafter, you know, the patient tells you, if you ask about it again a couple weeks later, oh, I don't do that anymore.
Yes.
That's when we hit the reel, right? In other words, we were talking about some incident from the past, perhaps, or some relationship to an important figure in the person's life. Things got said, and that changed something. To me, that's, you know, you hit the unconscious, right? You hit on something, an unconscious wish, an unconscious thought. We could also say somehow that another way of thinking about the real, obviously, in Lacanian terms is jouissance again, that the jouissance mm-hmm. is the real, and that somehow we managed to say something which led to a transformation in the person's libido or the person's jouissance. Sometimes, for people who are not that familiar with jouissance, just thinking of it as libido in a Freudian sense can be helpful, perhaps. That I used to really get off on X, and now I don't.
Right. And you give examples of this in your cases, multiple examples of, you know, and it usually involves bringing something to speech for the analysand, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so, you know, to me, the quantity of affect that comes out at any particular moment, that's not what's crucial. What's crucial is, does something change? And and in my own experience, what leads to the big changes, it may be a discussion that's accompanied by a lot of affect, but I mean, it isn't always. And in fact, probably the majority of the time, my sense is that it isn't. But it leads to, you know, a big change, an effective change, change in subjective position, a change in, you know, jouissance,
So we've talked a lot about jouissance. Now it's time to talk about desire.
Okay.
I've decided. So in Ethics of, the next chapter is Ethics of Psychoanalysis, and, you know, so Lacan has this point to make that it basically ensuring the analysand's goodness or that the analysand serves the good is not the aim of analysis. And in fact, we should be suspicious of this, right? And instead, Lacan elevates to an ethical stance, a statement, one should not give up on one's desire, or I've heard it or I've seen it translated more often as not give way on one's desire, which sounds a bit confusing. But so this actually, this almost gives me the chills when I, every time I read that, and I think it's so inspiring, but it scares me a little, you know. It feels to me, I mean, what does that really look like, I suppose, not to give way on one's desire? It occurs to me that not giving way is, could be quite destructive, actually.
I mean, as I always try to say, you know, we're not talking about, you know, the first desire the patient shows up with in analysis, which is, you know, world domination, or, you know, to sort of make everybody in their entourage suffer for all the ills they have done to them. But just to give a couple of examples, you know, the one of my patients at a certain moment, not even just at a certain moment, but for many years, was in love with a woman and, you know, never declared his desire for her. With 1,000 excuses of why the time was never right and, you know, the circumstances were never the right ones. I think what Lacan, with this ethical imperative, is saying, the worst aspects of neurosis have to do with giving up on your desire. And let me just return it to Freud for a moment. There's something that Lacan points out in Freud's work, is this particular word, Versagen. I don't know German, so I can't pronounce it very well, but I've looked into the word and I've looked at it in a number of contexts, and it's always translated in the standard edition as frustration. And frustration has become a sort of a big term, as far as I know, in Anglo-American psychoanalysis. And what actually, if you look closely at the German, what Freud is talking about very often is renunciation, that the analysand gives up on what she wants. She wants something, and instead of pursuing it, she lets it go. And that this kind of compromise, this willingness to let go of what we most want, is a big component of neurosis, and leading to regrets, leading to resentment against all those for whom we say to ourselves that we made that renunciation, right? We gave this person up, or we gave this particular thing. It could be a career choice. You know, there are lots of people who I've worked with who've said, you know, that they really wanted to do X. They really wanted to study music. And their parents said, you'll never make it as a musician. And, you know, instead they studied, you know, some science that they didn't really love. And, you know, and then at age 40 or 50, you know, they have a breakdown and, or, you know, what's typically referred to as a midlife crisis. And, you know, maybe they're even successful in this career, but they hate it. And, you know, I think, you know, there's sort of a very straightforward or simplistic reading of don't give up on your desire, as I like that one better than don't give ground relative to you. That sounds very stilted to me. Don't give up on your desire. There's a sort of a simplistic reading, and there's perhaps a more profound one. There's one that, you know, simplistically stated, you know, you're going to regret it if you give up on your desire. And there's a more profound one that that we all need desire to live. You know, that somehow it's the essence of ourselves is our desire and what we want. And it doesn't mean that we have to, you know, move heaven and earth at every moment to try to get it, but that especially we have to stop, you know, trying to believe our own excuses about why we're not pursuing what we want, you know, try to remove some of the obstacles that we place in our own way to achieving what we want. Mm-hmm. So
how does this relate to love, actually? Because Lacan's formulation of, well, it comes up in volume one as well, where I think you suggest, you know, or you repeat something Lacan says, that giving, you know, love is giving someone lack, or loving from a place of lack. Mm-hmm. And that means stimulating or driving the other's desire, or at least I understand it that way at times. I don't know if you act. I don't want to totally misattribute, but I mean, is that accurate, actually? Is that what love is, or is there more in Lacanian, you know, vocabulary, or is there more to it? I guess also a connected question for me is love necessarily, because love sounds very hysterical. It sounds like hysterical love is the only love possible in a way, if you formulated it in the way that I just have, but I could be totally wrong. So set me straight.
I mean, love and desire is, the two are related, and they're not always related. I've just finished a book that will hopefully come out in the fall called "The Love Is Giving What You Don't Have," right? And that's mm-hmm. a reading of Lacan's long discussion of love in Seminar 8, the transference seminar. I try to trace the way Freud talks about the divergent paths often between love and desire, especially in men, but also in women at times as well. Lacan, sometimes in his formulations, plays a little fast and loose with as he often does, with distinctions between, let's say, love and desire. But that formulation, and of course, Lacan, like Freud, has a lot to say about love and desire in the course of his, 50-plus years of writing. And so I try to focus, at least with that claim, love is giving what you don't have, on a particular formulation that's around, the early 60s in his work, repeated sometimes later, sometimes a little bit earlier. And the idea there is that you have to show and indicate very clearly and enunciate to another person that you lack, that you need something, that you're missing something. You have to indicate that you are castrated, so to speak, to another person, right? That you don't have what you want, that you are lacking in a certain regard, and that other person is somehow related to that lack. Not that other person fills that lack, but somehow that other person brings out the lack in you, brings out the desire in you, perhaps in what you were referring to as a kind of hysterical vein, the hope is that if I declare my lack to you, then that will bring out the lack in you, and you'll declare your lack to me. And that doesn't always happen, but is that what you were thinking of?
Yes, that's exactly right. Yes. Well, okay, we're running out of time, but I wanted to last time too. I wanted to ask about the cases a little bit and get to those. I noticed something about them, which is it became rather obvious to me. They're all men. Okay, let me just lay it out. I'm just going to say, a narrow demographic, they tend to have money too, trust funds. I mean, not all of them actually, but a good number of them I noticed. And I guess most of them are obsessives, which is not too surprising, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Either. But so is this a conscious choice? Did you decide? I mean, how did you select, I guess, the cases for these two volumes?
Right. I mostly selected what was already written up. There is the case of Tina in the other volume, and in the first essay here about the global economy, there is a case, there's a female analyst and as well. But, you know, one of the difficulties is with ongoing cases, you know, I just leave them out of publications, you know, that they can't, I feel they can't be included at this stage. Mm-hmm. And so, as you can see, this is a set of cases that I discussed over the years in certain places, and there were other cases that I couldn't present, often because of people being in the audience who I might have wanted to present. So yes, there's a certain skewedness to it there, but I would just say that because of, you know, when and where I made these presentations and what's still ongoing and what isn't, that's how the selection happened.
So it's, okay, the fact that they're all obsessives, or not all of them, a majority of them, is just a kind of where the chips fell, as it were.
Well, one of them, you know, I would definitely say that the, I think it's the last one, Contours of Trauma, is much more an hysteric male, and, you know, and some people and have told me, you know, they're sure now he's a masochist. So, and also don't forget in the first volume, there's the fetishist. So there, you know, there's a little more. And of course, the case of Tina is a case of psychosis. So,
yeah, I forgot about Tina. That's true.
Yeah, and that is, again, you know, cases of psychosis are ones where, you know, the publication is perhaps even trickier. So,
You know, speaking of the case, the Contours of Trauma case, you're an Alzan there. He's a gay man who's into S&M, and you explain that he's... at first, it's just online, and then offline, and eventually it takes this contractual form at first, where the parties agree in advance, you know, what's going to happen, their safe words and all that. And you say this sort of thing is mainstream, and you, the stuff of, you know, whatever, late capitalism, semblance, etc. But then things get more serious, and I guess he seems to be treading on dangerous territory, though you don't really spell it out what's going on, but You fear for him, and so you give him an ultimatum to stop engaging in these practices, or you'll end the analysis, right? And I was actually surprised that about this move, only because, you know, given Lacan's ethics and your own about normativity and analysis, or like sort of the pitfalls of like projecting your own values onto the analysand, and so it seemed pretty heavy-handed, and I thought, wow, something must have really. Well, I thought maybe, can you comment a little bit on that, and maybe you can talk about the decision with this man, or just more generally about such interventions, the place of such interventions in analysis?
Yeah, there was certainly, you sense there, and you're right, that, you know, there was something that had definitely concerned me for a long time, that I was hesitant to make any such demand about. And it seems to me, however, that when something becomes life-threatening, it threatens the analysis, right? In this case, I think we were talking in particular about suffocation, and it sort of becoming a bit more and more extreme as time went on, and I began to feel rather anxious about the whole thing, which is rare for me. I began to wonder if, in fact, you know, I wasn't the one in whom he was hoping to generate the anxiety. So it seems to me that, in the end, I've done this a number of times, not exactly in the same circumstances. Sometimes it's with drugs, sometimes with other things, but where the patient's life is at stake, it seems to me that we do have to take a stand. And as I said, one of the difficulties, as I said in that case, one of the difficulties is we have to feel that we have enough leverage that the importance of the analysis is great enough that the jouissance of this kind of, that they derive from this kind of behavior can be sacrificed or will be sacrificed by the patient. And two, it's a card you can only play once, right? If you say that, you know, I'm not willing to continue the analysis unless you stop, then you can't really backpedal after that. And you know, it does seem to me that, you know, from a Lacanian perspective, from a Freudian perspective, we do ally, so to speak, with the life drives against the death drive, right? Insofar as we associate the death drive with repetition compulsion, we do try to work against that, usually simply verbally, not by making any demands, right? Like, you know, give it up or else. But you know, sometimes the patient's behavior outruns our ability to let's say interpret it, such that we can sufficiently interpret it so that the patient won't kill himself before he kills himself.
Yeah.
Right? And so there's a time element that comes into play here. And but it, certainly it's not something that I recommend in general. It's when I was at my wit's end, obviously. I recall it was a rather trying moment when I gave this presentation, because there are various people in the audience said, oh, well, why don't you just send him to, you know, S&M groups, you know, and, you know, let him have a good time. I said, well, the problem was he wasn't having a good time. He was pretty close to killing himself. You know, it seems to me that, you know, the sort of non-clinical response to this sort of thing doesn't take seriously the way in which, you know, something very important could be at stake. And it could be a kind of acting out again. In other words, it could have been something that was being done essentially in order to have a certain effect on me, standing in for, you know, parental figures who he felt didn't rescue him.
Right, he's setting a limit, yeah.
But still the hope would be normally that if the patient is acting out, that certain interpretations would be enough to put a stop to that. But if you can't find the interpretations required to put a stop to it before it's too late, then it doesn't do much good to insist upon interpreting only.
And I should say that, yeah, just because I don't know if you mentioned it in our conversation just now, but in the case, it seems like he did stop. It worked.
Yeah, it worked.
Okay. Well, on that more positive note, before we go, can you just say a few words maybe about what you're working on now? Because I you know, you mentioned the love book, which I'm looking forward to. Maybe there's other stuff too.
Yes. Well, the three main projects. The love book is done now, and it's a sort of a long commentary on Freud and Lacan on love, and in particular Lacan's detailed exploration of Plato's Symposium in Seminar 8, which I've just translated, and that'll be out by the same press, Polity Press, I think in August, and then my commentary on it will come out sometime a few weeks later. And then I'm toying with the idea, I don't know if it'll happen, but I'm toying with the idea of sort of taking the work that I've done on Freud the last 20 years in teaching at Duquesne University and turning that into a book. And particularly, not just, you know, another book on Freud, because there are millions of them, but maybe something, you know, with talking about the enduring clinical relevance of Freud's work. And so not going into, you know, all kinds of theoretical details, but talking about clinical things. And then I'm hoping to translate another seminar. It's seminar 16, d'un autre à l'autre, mm-hmm. from one other to the other, which is, you know, getting closer to the later work.
Keep those seminars coming. I'm relying on your translations here.
Well, at least we're lucky now that, you know, several of them are in the works, and we, mm-hmm. you know, there is a press now that is really working actively to bring them out. So
that's great.
That's good news, yeah.
All right, Bruce. Well, maybe you can come back at some point. You know, the love book. We could talk about love for the full 50 minutes.
Okay. I would love to. And your questions
I put
are
you
always,
on the spot.
yeah. The questions are always thought-provoking, and there's always way too much to address. But I certainly have enjoyed talking with you.
Me too. Thanks. Thanks for doing this twice. And And thanks to our audience for listening. Happy New Year, and till next time. Bye-bye.